This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 3rd, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, while President Obama visits Mexico, protesters demand an end to U.S. deportations. Climate change talks wrap up in Bonn, Germany, as new data shows a rise in carbon levels in the atmosphere. And we'll go to New York, where meat department workers are on strike over poor working conditions. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. President Barack Obama arrived in Costa Rica today, making him the first U.S. president since 1997 to visit. Obama will meet with the Costa Rican president and other Central American leaders. FSRN's Sarah Blasky reports from San Jose.
The Central American leaders will be discussing economic development and how to combat regional violence. Gustavo Arias, a political analyst for the Costa Rican paper La Nación, told FSRN that the so-called war on drugs is at the top of the list of reasons for strengthening ties to Central America.
We are clearly the route for all the drug trafficking from Colombia to Mexico. There is also the situation with the cartels in this zone. The policy of President Barack Obama and of North America in general is that Central America is very connected in relation to security and the war against narcotics.
Recent investments from China and Costa Rica also provide incentive for re-strengthening relations, according to Victor Artavia, a member of the New Socialist Party of Costa Rica.
Costa Rica, under the administration of Oscar Arias, broke relations with Taiwan and allied with China, and China began to have more ties in Costa Rica. The Chinese built the national stadium in San Jose. Now I think they're going to build the refinery in the Atlantic, so they're beginning to have more of a presence. So it could be that this is generating some worries.
Although Obama has around a 70% approval rating here, some Costa Ricans, including Artavia, are protesting the visit. With Jesse Chapman, this is Sarah Blasky, FSRN, San Jose.
Rhode Island's governor signed legislation last night legalizing same-sex marriage. In a statement, Governor Lincoln Chafee said his signature means the state is, quote, at last upholding its legacy as a place founded on the principles of tolerance and diversity. Rhode Island is now the 10th state to advance marriage equality. In related news, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled today that gay and lesbian couples have the same rights as heterosexuals to be listed on a newborn's birth certificate. The state argued against this, saying it would create legal paternity confusion, but the justices said both members of straight couples are listed on birth certificates, even if the woman was artificially inseminated. The U.S. unemployment rate dropped in April to 7.5%. The Labor Department also updated job creation numbers for earlier this year, showing the economy added jobs much faster than previously thought. A New York appeals court says local communities do have the right to ban oil and gas development within their jurisdiction. In a ruling Thursday, the court upheld a decision allowing the small upstate New York towns of Dryden and Middlefield to ban fracking. Harvard Law School's Sean Goho said Thursday's ruling won't be binding in other states, but towns around the country are watching closely.
Municipalities have shown a new interest in passing such ordinances, and this interest is being driven primarily by the rise of shale gas and shale oil. And fracking is bringing gas drilling into places that haven't had to deal with it before.
A lawyer for Norse Energy, the Norwegian company who appealed, said they are looking into taking the case to a higher court. Tensions are running high along the Turkey-Syria border following a deadly clash Thursday involving Turkish border guards and alleged Syrian rebels. The incident has sparked outrage in the Turkish border town of Akçakale. Police dispersed a group of 500 demonstrators who had marched on a nearby Syrian refugee camp housing 35,000 people. This comes as a report from the International Crisis Group released this week warns that Turkey is struggling to absorb the hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees fleeing the country's civil war. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
The ICG report notes that Turkey's leadership miscalculated when they wagered that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad would stand aside in the face of a popular uprising. Instead, Turkey is in the midst of dealing with a humanitarian crisis as it struggles to accommodate the thousands of refugees languishing on the border. One of the report's lead contributors, Hugh Pope in Istanbul, points out that there are already nearly 450,000 Syrian refugees inside Turkey, and the United Nations says that figure could double.
Turkey really needs to open up to international aid, and the international community has also got to be a little more engaged with how Turkey does the aid. Turkey is effective and experienced in dealing with this, and together they can design a smart new strategy to get the aid over into northern Syria as well.
The report also notes that international aid organizations say they have trouble registering in Turkey. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
The government of Zimbabwe says it has failed to meet universal access goals for treatment of children with HIV and AIDS. The government blames obsolete equipment and a critical shortage of pediatric doctors. FSRN's Gerikai Chanza reports from Harare.
At least 1.3 million people are living with HIV and AIDS in Zimbabwe. More than 600,000 need antiretroviral treatments, including about 100,000 children. Dr. Owen Mugurungi is the AIDS and TB director with the Ministry of Health. He told reporters in Harare Thursday that because of capacity issues, only 42% of children born with the pandemic are receiving antiretroviral treatment.
But for adults, it's actually about 89%. For children, we have not achieved universal access. But we have achieved universal access in terms of numbers for everybody. And for adults, but for children, we have a long way to go.
Universal access to AIDS treatment and prevention is an international public health goal, but donor fatigue is threatening worldwide efforts, including those in Zimbabwe, where development partners are now funneling money to other initiatives such as climate change mitigation projects. Gerikai Chaunza, FSRN, Harare.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Island countries and nations most affected by climate change are calling for action as the latest round of UN-backed talks wrap up today in Bonn, Germany. The talks lay the groundwork for November's International Climate Summit in Poland, which aims to secure an international agreement by 2015. Scientists warn that the amount of carbon in the atmosphere has reached urgent levels and much sooner than expected. According to data this week from the Scripps Institution for Oceanography, the amount of the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide is expected to pass 400 parts per million this month, the first time in human history. Climate activists like former NASA scientist James Hansen and 350.org have said that carbon levels need to get below 350 in order to avoid irreversible effects from climate change. For more, we're joined by Mina Rahman. She's the climate change and negotiations expert with the Third World Network, and she joins us from Bonn. Mina Rahman, welcome back to FSRN.
Yes, we're happy to be back.
One of the tracks at this week's talks has been to focus on coming up with a plan of action, a treaty on climate change by 2015, by that deadline that was set in Durban. Has there been progress on this?
Well, there has been a little bit of progress. Parties were basically discussing what the elements of the agreement would be and what kind of proposals they are thinking about. So it was much more of an exchange of views in relation to how the various parties saw the agreement. So this session was largely conceptual and also in an exploration stage.
A group of developing countries released a statement today saying that they are taking on more of the burden of cutting greenhouse gases than richer countries like the United States. They point to a recent study from the Stockholm Environment Institute and Oxfam that estimates that more than 60% of emission cuts by 2020 will be made by developing countries. What has been the response this week from richer nations?
What we are seeing here is that developed countries, particularly led by the United States, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, what is called the umbrella group, they are basically proposing a kind of agreement where all the targets or commitments for countries would be determined nationally. They want to talk about self-identification of the targets, and what we in the civil society called pledge and review world. So they are not talking about commitments which are consistent with what the science demands or what equity demands.
Well, if, as you're noting, the richer nations are proposing more national legislation or national action rather than international agreements in the United States, despite the U.S. President Barack Obama highlighting climate change as a key item in his second term, the U.S. still lacks comprehensive national legislation or a national law on this issue.
Well, let me clarify. I think what they talked about is a nationally determined target, meaning every country will do what it will identify as appropriate for it, either through its own legislation or through other means from the domestic front, which they will commit internationally.
I see. So to clarify, as you're saying, there would still be an international agreement that the nations would agree to.
Yes, it will be, basically it's what's called whatever that they are able to do at the national level is what they will commit to internationally. That's called self-identification or nationally determined targets. What many developing countries are saying, and what civil society has been saying, is that you can't have nationally determined targets for the developed countries because there is already an ambition gap, emissions gap happening right now.
And there's also the historical context, the fact
exactly.
that many of the wealthier countries are wealthy because they benefited from an
yes,
industrial
exactly.
revolution, an economy that contributed to the current situation, and that wouldn't be in consideration under the process you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. The developed countries are also not wanting to acknowledge historical responsibility because, as we know, much of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere today are largely due to the historical emissions that have happened.
Meena Raman with the Third World Network. One of the meetings today in Bonn focused on long-term finance of climate action. This was also a key point in Durban. The finance would include a green climate fund, a fund to protect the world's forests and forest communities. Has there been progress in this area?
Well, at the moment in the discussions, developing countries were basically saying that if they don't see any movement on the finance side, there's very little they're going to be able to do in the new treaty, in the new agreement. So there's only been discussions. There hasn't been any commitment. They are pushing developed countries to make firm commitments. And what we would like to see at the talks in 3 weeks from now, there would be longer discussions on this very subject.
Meena Raman is the climate change negotiations expert with the Third World Network. She joined us from Bonn, Germany at the latest round of UN-backed climate talks. Meena Raman, thanks for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Over the last few days, protesters gathered at the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City, calling on U.S. President Barack Obama to end deportations and stop the separation of families. Migrant justice groups said they plan to dedicate a plaque to remember migrants who have been killed or disappeared while traveling to the U.S. The demonstrations were held today while Obama met with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto at the National Palace. FSRN's Don Paley reports.
Guadalupe Tomas Rodriguez is 34 years old. She's from Tlaxcala State in central Mexico. She's trying to raise four children between the ages of 4 and 15 alone. Her husband hasn't come home from the U.S. in 4 years. She struggles to explain what it is like for her kids to grow up without a dad.
A football team recently came to my son's school, and my son talked to his father and said, "Dad, why aren't you here with me? You never teach me to play soccer. I have a 4-year-old girl, and it's the same thing." She says to me, "Mommy, why can't I touch my dad?"
Tomás Rodríguez is one of an estimated 30 million Mexicans who live in their home country, but whose lives are directly impacted by migration. U.S. President Barack Obama is expected to discuss migration and U.S. immigration reform in talks with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto. While there are fans and critics of the proposed immigration bill in the U.S. Senate, many south of the border say it falls short. One reason is it doesn't address the root causes of migration, which are economic, and the measure will do little to change the conditions of people who are forced to migrate to survive. For Tomás Rodríguez, the problem isn't just a lack of work. It's a lack of well-paying work. In her state, minimum wage is 7 pesos, or 57 cents, an hour.
If you stop and think about it, if you work 8 hours, 7 times 8, a person can't survive on $4.61 a day. Let's say we'd almost be able to feed ourselves with that. But how would we be able to dress ourselves? What about our kids' education, our home?
Over the past 20 years, minimum wage has remained stagnant, and changes to labor laws have made work more precarious in Mexico. At the same time, the cost of living has risen sharply. Marco Antonio Castillo has worked with migrants and their families in Mexico for over a decade. He places the blame for Mexico's mass migration squarely on the North American Free Trade Agreement, signed in 1994 between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada.
NAFTA, specifically the Free Trade Agreement, have been pushing people outside of their rural and indigenous hometowns, and they've been pushing them to the cities, but in Mexico there are not better conditions. We are not stupid. We know that if we're going to leave our villages, it's better to go where the money is. So that's why basically NAFTA means much more migration.
Castillo says those drafting NAFTA should have considered its impact on forced migration.
Maybe this was the intention of this free trade agreement, to create unregulated workforce traveling abroad and exposing their lives.
Adding to the danger of migration is the U.S.-backed war on drugs. According to Molly Malloy, a librarian in New Mexico who tracks homicides in Mexico, more than 125,000 people have been killed since 2007. Another 27,000 people have been disappeared. Routes used by migrants and the entire U.S.-Mexico border area have become conflict zones. Since 2010, numerous massacres of migrants have occurred in northern states. Their bodies have turned up in mass graves or on public display, hanging from bridges or cut into pieces. Dominga Teodolo, whose husband works in New York, says that he won't come home and visit for fear of crossing the U.S.-Mexico border.
The border is really dangerous, and my husband says, how am I supposed to come? I'm already 40-something years old, and I can't be running around the border.
Ruben Figueroa helps run a shelter for migrants in Tenosique, a Mexican city not far from the border with Guatemala. Most of the people who pass through the shelter are Hondurans, fleeing violence and poverty in their home country. Figueroa explains that criminals threaten, extort, and kill migrants. And he says they do so with the complicity of police and migration officials.
Here, there are many economic interests on the part of organized crime. Migrants, for them, are like a product. What they don't realize is that it is a migration of poor people, a forced migration, and that the migrants don't carry money. The criminals try and force them to give them money. They torture them until they get a number of a family member in the U.S. If they don't get the number, they kill them.
Figueroa himself was once a migrant, and today he is again under threat for the services he provides to the men, women, and children who pass through the shelter.
We estimate that for every 10 people who come through here, only 4 will make it to the north border, and about 2 will successfully cross to the U.S. The rest are deported, kidnapped, assassinated, or they stay and work here.
The migration between the U.S. and Mexico has a long history. Life for migrants wasn't always this difficult. Renowned historian Adolfo Gili addressed that issue at a panel discussion in Mexico City last week.
The situation of migrants has gotten worse. Wasn't like this 10 years ago. It wasn't like this 15 years ago. It's part of a huge national tragedy. This country is living through a huge tragedy.
Mexican migrants in the U.S., as well as those passing through Mexico, and their entire families could be impacted by U.S. immigration reform. But their stories make clear that until the material conditions in their communities are addressed, forced migration, exploitation, and the separation of families will continue. Don Paley, FSRN, Mexico City.
Speaking to students at the Anthropology Museum in Mexico City today, President Barack Obama said a new Mexico is emerging, in part because of its willingness to discard old habits that aren't working. But during his visit to Latin America, he has repeatedly voiced support for several long-standing policies related to drugs and law enforcement that human rights groups say cause violence and displacement in Mexico and don't reduce drug trafficking. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
The U.S. has spent more than $1.5 billion taxpayer dollars on the anti-narcotics program Plan Merida since it began in 2008. That money has bought aircraft, surveillance equipment, and weapons for Mexico's military, funded training for prison guards, police, and soldiers, and expanded the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. During a summit with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto this week, President Obama praised this program and pledged to continue it. But in a speech Friday to university students in Mexico City, the president said U.S. policy should also address the underlying forces that empower drug trafficking cartels.
We understand that much of the root cause of violence that's been happening here in Mexico, for which so many Mexicans have suffered, is the demand for illegal drugs in the United States. And so we've got to continue to make progress on that front. I've been asked, and I honestly do not believe that legalizing drugs is the answer, but I do believe that a comprehensive approach, not just law enforcement, but education and prevention and treatment, that's what we have to do.
As the number of people killed, disappeared, and displaced by drug-related violence continues to rise across Latin America, President Obama's position against legalizing drugs is increasingly isolated. Guatemala's Otto Pérez Molina and Colombia's Juan Manuel Santos, two fairly conservative presidents, have both criticized the waste of money and human lives in several decades of a war on drugs and called on the U.S. to consider alternatives. Former Mexican presidents Felipe Calderón and Vicente Fox have joined this call, and Uruguay could soon become the first nation in the world to officially legalize and regulate marijuana. Daniel Ribello, a researcher with the Drug Policy Alliance, says President Obama's unwillingness to discuss legalization will continue to hamper efforts to combat crime and violence in Mexico.
The prohibition of drugs has created these vast drug cartels, immensely powerful, and because prohibition has driven the market for drugs underground, it's inherently a violent industry. We've seen human rights abuses go through the roof, and often it's the security forces, either the military or the federal police, that are doing much of the killing.
Under the Merida Initiative, a portion of each year's funding is conditioned on a number of human rights criteria, which Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and other groups say the country has not met. They've documented thousands of instances of the U.S.-funded Mexican security forces committing acts of torture, rape, extrajudicial killings, forced disappearances, and widespread impunity for these crimes, and called on the State Department to withhold funding until these abuses are addressed. But the U.S. has continued to authorize the money.
It sends the wrong message, both to the public and to the Mexican government, that we're not that serious about enforcing our human rights safeguards in Mérida as a matter of law.
That's Salvador Sarmiento with the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Human Rights. He says in reauthorizing the Mérida Initiative without demanding reform, the U.S. risks supporting the ongoing suppression of indigenous and campesino activists by Mexico's security forces. The president will wrap up his Latin American tour Friday and Saturday with a visit to Costa Rica. Costa Rican President Laura Chinchilla, who will be meeting with President Obama, has also called for considering drug legalization as a method of reducing violence in Latin America. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
This is FSRN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
In Queens, New York, meat department workers at trade fair supermarkets have been striking from work to protest what they say are unfair labor practices. FSRN's Salim Rizvi has more from New York.
Around 100 meat department workers at 9 trade fair supermarkets in Queens began their strike 6 weeks ago on March 13. The workers, who are members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 342, initially went on strike after their boss threatened and harassed them during contract negotiations, according to the union. The new contract would have frozen wages, reduced hours from full to part-time, cut healthcare benefits, and higher pay rates on Sundays. Richard Finlay is one of the workers at Trade Fair.
He locked us out unfairly because we went out because he was treating us unfairly. Okay, but we walked out because of the harassment. We're working with machinery, working with knives, and we're cutting, and they keep harassing us. Come on, guys, move it, move it. If you don't move, we're going to fire you. And those are all the threats that we were getting, and a lot of harassment, cursing at us. And so we went out for 2 hours, and we tried to return back to work. He locked us out, which is illegal. So that's where it all started from.
That was 6 weeks ago. Since then, Finlay and some other workers have been hired back, but at reduced wages and hours and without benefits. Again, Finlay.
You know, it's not right. We got family. We got to feed our family. And, you know, I'm in there 24 hours, not a manager anymore, making $3 less an hour. Not working on Sundays anymore. Took that away from me. So basically, he barely digged into my income. Took a big chunk out of my income. That's what he did. Just so he doesn't have to play unemployment.
Kate Meckler is the director of communications of Local 342.
Even though the company is slowly trying to bring some of the workers back, bringing them back at part-time hours with no Sunday pay, not their original stores, not their original classifications, and cutting their rates of pay is absolutely not acceptable. Not acceptable.
The company has replaced some of the striking workers with temporary workers. The union says that Trade Fair is violating collective bargaining laws by relocating some of the rehired workers to different stores. Some elected officials support the workers. New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn joined the striking workers in front of Trade Fair store in Jackson Heights recently.
We're going to take the complaints that relate to this store to the city agencies. We're going to get enforcement. We're going to do everything we could crack down. And I just hope Danny and I coming to them make sure they know they're not alone. We're standing here with them and we're going to keep fighting with them.
The workers' union has filed charges against Trade Fair at the National Labor Relations Board. Meanwhile, workers continue to picket daily. Salim Rizvi, FSRN, New York.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Pucklow and Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Carla West. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.